As Russia attacks Ukraine's Eastern Front, the U.S. sends more weapons, arms that are geared to defending the Donbas.
To modernize Teddy Roosevelt's famous advice, sometimes you will speak softly and carry a large javelin.
I'm Marco Werman. Also this hour, what it takes to get someone to testify against a former head of state for war crimes. The Bosnian War has some stark lessons.
We can't just let you skate because you came in afterwards to tell the story. You also have to take responsibility.
Plus, with pathways getting cut off for legal migration,
many more Cubans have been turning to migrating irregularly.
Tens of thousands more. Cuban officials are at the White House today trying to work out a solution. All that and more coming up this hour on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us. Today in Washington, President Biden announced that the U.S. is sending additional aid to Ukraine. The $800 million package includes weaponry suited for fighting in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine.
This package includes heavy artillery weapons, dozens of howitzers, and 144,000 rounds of ammunition to go with those howitzers. It also includes more tactical drones.
Biden said the equipment is responsive to Ukraine's needs as Russia prepares to launch a new ground offensive in eastern Ukraine.
To modernize Teddy Roosevelt's famous advice, sometimes you will speak softly and carry a large javelin.
We're joined now by Jeffrey Edmonds. He's a Russian military analyst with the Center for Naval Analysis. He's worked at the White House, the CIA, and served for over two decades in the U.S. Army. Jeffrey Edmonds, tell us about the weapons Biden mentioned in his comments. What are they and what's their significance at this moment in the war?
So what he's most recently announced are, medium-range artillery pieces as well as armored vehicles, and then more of the same type of equipment that we've been giving them so far. And I think that's important because the nature of the fight in the East is somewhat different than what we've seen so far.
So put this aid package into context for us. How meaningful is another $800 million in military aid for Ukraine? We're talking howitzers, ammunition for them, tactical drones. How long is all that going to last?
I think it's a significant package for the Ukrainians because they're really going to need as much firepower as they can to contest the Russian expansion in the East. And one of the big things that the Russians relied on in 2015, 2014 and 15 was artillery. So giving them this kind of artillery helps them better fight back against the Russians.
So helpful, but what happens if this war stretches out for months or even years? Will the U.S. just continue sending military aid as long as the fighting wears on? What is the plan?
I think we likely will. I'm not sure that it will carry out for that long, to be honest with you. I mean, the Russians, the prospects of the Russians are a little bit better with the operation in the East, but it's not very clear that they can obtain even these revised strategic objectives they have of holding on to these regional areas. And so I think that, that being said, we have plenty of these weapon systems on hand, and I think we're going to continue to see the same kind of level of support.
It's interesting. Some countries are moving slowly on military aid. Germany, for example, is reluctant to send some heavy artillery to Ukraine. What is going on? Why are some countries holding back that aid?
Well, I think the Germans, have a more challenging domestic issue. Germany has always played this role or believed that more cooperation with the Russians would in some way stabilize the situation. And that clearly isn't the case. And so that being said, though, the Germans are coming around. And so I think, each country has to decide what role they're going to play in this. But in general, everybody's been pretty shocked by and delighted by the level of solidarity we've had in the West.
Now, in his comments today, Biden mentioned that what's coming will be a different phase of the war. He said it will be fought differently because of geography, because of other reasons. Can you help us understand, Jeffrey, what is going to be different now?
Yeah, so again, from the Russian perspective, there are three things that improve their ability to fight. One is their logistics is simpler and more secure. Two, it's a smaller geographic area within which they can concentrate combat power. And three, with the appointment of a commanding general, their command and control might be better. And so you've got, a tighter area, they're more open fields of fire. It's not quite as urban as some of the fighting that we've seen so far. Although I would say that a lot of that fighting took place outside Kyiv. So I don't want to make it sound like there's a 180 degree difference here, but you do have a more open fight, something that's a little more traditional, something that Russians have trained for. That being said, they do have a force that's pretty beat up, so with low morale, and that might be determinative at this point.
We should note that earlier this week, Russia tested a new intercontinental ballistic missile considered Russia's most powerful, capable of carrying a nuclear warhead. So the signals Putin is sending seem obvious. Does this reveal, though, any new capability that the U.S. and other countries did not know Russia had?
It does not. We've been following the development of this missile for a long time, and it's part of Russia's modernization efforts for their strategic nuclear forces. The launch of this missile has actually been delayed for a couple of years. And even if you didn't have the Ukraine conflict, Ukraine war, they probably would have launched it, you know, at some point this year. But I do think the timing and his comments around the launch are what's important as far as signaling for the West.
So, Jeffrey, just about half a minute to go. Even as the U.S. and other countries have been providing military aid, Ukrainian officials are asking for more. What do you think Ukraine's biggest need is right now?
I think they need more of the heavier systems, more artillery, aircraft, tanks, armored vehicles, to really, really be able to push against Russia's attempts to expand in the East. I think those are going to really, really, in some ways, determine a large part of how this conflict turns out.
Jeffrey Edmonds, a Russia military analyst with the Center for Naval Analysis, speaking with us about the latest round of U.S. military aid to Ukraine. Jeffrey, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
In Sri Lanka, the country is on the verge of economic collapse and is asking the International Monetary Fund for help. Sri Lankans have endured worsening food and fuel shortages, and thousands of protesters have taken to the streets calling for the ouster of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa. We're joined on the line by Kalani Kumarasinghe. She's an editor with the Daily Mirror based in Colombo. Kalani, can you start by telling us briefly how Sri Lanka came into this economic crisis in the first place?
The pandemic, coupled with very limited foreign reserves and very bad debt management, all of this brought us to this situation we're in right now, where we are basically unable to provide for our citizens in terms of providing them with fuel, providing them medicines, and we're even dealing with a food shortage as we speak.
So elaborate on how the pandemic led to this economic crisis.
The immediate response by the government when it came to the pandemic was to stop foreign exchange outflows from the country. This, along with the fact that tourism and our migrant workers providing us the dollars we need, all of this too came to a standstill when the pandemic happened.
Were there signs earlier than now that currency outflows from Sri Lanka could eventually cause problems for the country?
Yes, certainly. Sri Lanka is a country where we are used to subsidies and populist political measures to hand out things at lower rates where the state is not making any profits. We're not even barely making things even. Opposition, economists, credit rating agencies, all of these warn Sri Lanka that if we are not going to correct our course, that we will eventually be in this situation. But the central bank and the government together, their actions have been very arrogant and they were not willing to listen to these criticisms for a long time. And the result is what we have right now.
I gather President Rajapaksa earlier this week said maybe he should have gone to the IMF earlier. Why didn't he?
Because the IMF would expect us to restructure not just our debt, but a lot of things that are not working in Sri Lanka, that is, especially when it comes to all the allegations of corruption, when we see these development projects that the Rajapaksa regime undertook. There were so many huge development projects implemented with foreign aid, and these have largely become white elephants. They're not earning any revenue. They're not of any use. People are now, you know, demanding for transparency. They're demanding for the Rajapaksas to be audited, so that Sri Lankans can find out what happened to all this money and hopefully bring that money back if it's at all possible.
So I'm really curious, Kalani, to know what all this means for the average Sri Lankan on a daily basis. I mean, they're the ones who have to cope with these food and fuel shortages.
Everything is affected, not just our transport, but we can't generate electricity. And we had to deal with 10 to 14 hour power cuts. And that is when things got really bad and people were really frustrated. And that is when they all took to the streets in protest.
And this is not just the working poor. It's also the middle class, I understand.
Certainly, everything is expensive. A loaf of bread is double the price of what it used to be, and people are buying things what they used to buy in kilos. They would now buy in 100 grams or 200 grams, such small portions. So that means people are consuming less and people are making compromises with their meals. The middle class would be foregoing their snacks because things like even a biscuit is expensive. But for the others, for those who can't even afford that, they're definitely foregoing their meals. They can't afford their staple rice or vegetables. So it's a really stressful situation.
I mean, is this a situation that has affected your own life? I mean, what compromises have you had to make?
Well, I've had to time my travel and work around the power cuts or when we are able to find fuel for our vehicles, things like that. Since I work mainly at an office in the capital, Colombo, I've not been affected by the power cuts as much as my other colleagues who are not working in the capital. So basically, it's been very tough to deal with skyrocketing prices of food and fuel. But I know many others are having it much, much worse out there.
In the meantime, the 1% of Sri Lanka seem to be thriving. Who's benefited from the dysfunction at the top, and do they still support the Rajapaksas?
Well, it certainly isn't very clear as to who is supporting the Rajapaksas at this time. But I'd say many people, even the wealthiest, did take to the streets, especially when there was a curfew and a social media ban implemented, emergency rule that was imposed overnight. So all of these things were basically efforts by the government to curtail our rights. So even the 1% did not like that. They took to the streets to protest against this. So I'd say the pressure is on, but I can't say for sure who is supporting the government at this moment. All I know for sure is that not everyone is happy with this government. I'd expect many, even the business community, some of them have pressured the government to heed to the people's will. But what will happen, we will have to wait and see.
Kalani Kumarasinghe is an editor with the Daily Mirror. She joined us from Colombo, the Sri Lankan capital. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you for having me.
If you're craving some rich, salty goodness, it is hard to beat ramen. From your favorite soup joint, even those instant packs do the trick for the awesome slurpy broth and noodles. All that salt, though, not so awesome for your health.
生活習慣病, これの重症化を防いだり、予防、発症を予防するためには...
Ais Sato is with Kirin Holdings, a Japanese beverage company, selling an alternative. She said in a video featured on Taiwan Plus News that cutting out salt would mean eating bland food. So her company, of course, has a solution. They teamed up with researchers to invent electric chopsticks that they say make food taste saltier than it actually is. The chopsticks look like chopsticks, but they're attached by a cord to a small computer you wear on your wrist, kind of like a giant smartwatch. Meiji University researcher Home Miyashita explains, also in a video on Taiwan Plus News. He says the device uses electricity to attract sodium ions in the food to the chopsticks and then slightly alters those ions. So when you raise the chopsticks to your mouth with a bite of food, it all tastes saltier. If you want to run your own test on it to see if it actually works, you'll have to wait a bit. The team behind the salty chopsticks say they hope to have them available for purchase next year. An attack on a mosque in northern Afghanistan today is just the latest in a string of violent events there this week that have targeted the Shiite Hazara community.
I'm telling you, it's not the first time that happened with us. Hazara people, they are not safe in Afghanistan. They are not safe.
This woman's family members were among the victims of today's attacks. We'll hear more from her next on the program. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. This was the scene today in northern Afghanistan, as captured in a video posted online. The camera pans across the floor of a mosque as rescuers attend to the victims of an explosion. The bombing today at a Shiite mosque in Mazar-e-Sharif killed at least 10 people. It follows two other bombings earlier this week at schools outside Kabul. One thing these attacks have in common, the victims were members of a religious minority in Afghanistan, the Hazara. Batul Golami is from Afghanistan and Hazara herself. She's a women's rights activist and joins us from Islamabad, Pakistan. Batul, you've seen the video widely shared from the mosque that was bombed today. You've been following this news. What happened today? What happened this morning? Why was the mosque bombed?
One of the reasons that they targeted today in the mosque was being a Shia, because they all the time was against the Shia faith in Afghanistan.
So the Islamic State claimed responsibility for today's attack. Their claim is that they're a Sunni organization. Is it a Sunni attack on a Shia group of Hazaras? Is that how you see it?
Yes, obviously, because these all call as infidel. They are not even called as Muslim. Shia people and Hazara are infidel. They are not Muslim.
I understand members of your own family were in the mosque, Mazar-i Sharif. Are they okay?
No, unfortunately. I lost my second cousin today at this bomb blast. One of them killed and two of them injured. And both of that injured cousins are still in the hospital right now.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
And it's not the first time. 2 months ago also, I lost another cousin, second cousin, and he killed by a Talib in front of his door.
So the Islamic State, as you said, they call Hazaras infidels. What has been the reaction from the Taliban government to what's going on?
There is no reaction of them. Can you believe even there is not permission for the media, for the people of the local underground to share the update about this situation?
A Taliban spokesman told our reporter Shirin Jafari today that they would boost security across the country and especially in Hazara areas. But we've also seen that for one reason or another, the Taliban have not been able to prevent these attacks. What do you make of their promises?
No, we don't have any trust to Taliban. We know, I know, you know, and the world knows that the security issues is going on in Afghanistan. But no, this is specifically and systemically targeting of Hazara in Afghanistan.
These latest attacks that we've seen this week, what do you think that says about security for the Hazara going forward?
I can tell that totally right now for Hazara people, there is no security. They have nothing right now. Even they cannot go outside of country as well.
Who is speaking up for the Hazara people today, either inside Afghanistan or outside the country?
Unfortunately, right now, from inside Afghanistan, we don't have more voices because you know that they are under the security threats. So the most voices are from outside Afghanistan. You know, we have our social media with us. You know, whatever we can receive up this from Afghanistan, we will share. And, you know, at least we can raise this voice.
You're not currently in Afghanistan yourself. You're in Pakistan. Does that have anything to do with the security situation back in Afghanistan?
Yes, I'm in Pakistan because I want to be alive. I know if I go to Afghanistan, there is no more chance of living for me. But unfortunately, my all family members are in Afghanistan right now, and I'm, you know, just worried about all of them, that if it happened to my cousin, tomorrow it may happen to my brothers as well, because there is a lot of other chances. So, yes, there is no security for me and for others as well, Hazaras in Afghanistan.
Batul Ghulami is a Hazara women's rights activist from Afghanistan, speaking with us from Islamabad, Pakistan, about a string of attacks targeting members of Afghanistan's Hazara community. Batul, thank you very much for speaking with us. And again, our condolences to you and your family.
Thank you.
Cuban migrants are coming to the United States in the highest numbers since 1980. Trump-era policies made it much harder for them to do this legally, which is why U.S. and Cuban officials are sitting down today in Washington. It is the first high-level meeting with Havana since President Joe Biden took office. The hope is that both countries will reactivate agreements that were in place before President Trump took office. The world's Tibi Saisaya has more.
Esteban Rodriguez just arrived in the U.S. 2 weeks ago. He came from Cuba, where he says he was jailed for 10 months after he joined anti-government protests last summer. In this video, people are forming a human chain to try to prevent Rodriguez from being detained by a police officer. He says he was tortured by Cuban security officials.
Estamos hablando de estar encadenado, hermanos, y vivo más de 24 horas en una celda de castigo totalmente oscura con un.
I was cuffed around my hands and feet in a dark cell with little ventilation for more than 24 hours, he says. They hit me multiple times and threatened my family. Rodriguez says many of his Cuban friends were sentenced to long prison terms for taking part in protests last summer. He says he was expelled from the island and sent on a plane to Nicaragua.
Yo no pude ni despedirme de mi madre, no pude despedirme de mi familia, me llevaron hasta el aeropuerto y me sacaron de mi país.
I couldn't say goodbye to my mother or my family. They took me to the airport and I had to leave my country, he says. Almost 80,000 Cubans have arrived in U.S. ports of entry since last fall. And since Nicaragua made it easier for Cubans to travel through their country, Most are coming by land. In this video posted on Twitter, about a dozen migrants are crossing the Rio Grande into Texas. There are men, women, and children, some riding on their parents' shoulders. It's the last step of a long and dangerous journey, a journey that Rodriguez had to take. He says, I had to sleep in a cramped shelter with 100 people around me. I'm traveling a truck container with children and women. I was constantly scared of being kidnapped. Once Rodriguez made it onto U.S. soil, he requested asylum. Since the 1990s, the U.S. has allowed 20,000 Cubans to legally immigrate every year. But the Trump administration shut down visa services in Cuba, and that had a huge impact, according to Jessica Bolter. She's with the Migration Policy Institute.
With legal pathways cut off, many more Cubans have been turning to migrating irregularly through Central America up to the U.S.-Mexico border.
Despite the barriers, Cubans keep coming.
Cuando tú le preguntas a un joven en Cuba qué cuál es su sueño, lo primero que te dice es conocer a un extranjero.
Rodriguez says the dream of any young person in Cuba is to leave the country. With high inflation, food shortages, power outages, and political oppression, they see no reason to stay. And at times, the Cuban government seems ready to see them leave. That's according to John Suarez with Center for a Free Cuba.
The Cuban government has repeatedly used migration as a political weapon.
He says every time there is a social or economic crisis in Cuba, the government tends to open the escape valve.
The exodus is exporting people dissatisfied with the regime, which creates a double benefit. It reduces the opposition voices in the country. And secondly, it creates a situation where those disaffected, for the most part, will start working abroad and will start sending remittances back.
Suarez hopes that today's talks between Washington and Havana will reestablish an easier path for Cubans hoping to find a better life in the U.S. For the world, I'm Tibisay Sea.
Sanctioning Russia is a task that lends itself to analogies. Cut off one path for cash to get to Putin, and another opens up.
It's like cutting off the head of the Hydra. Another one grows back, or another analogy is whack-a-mole.
But there is one major source of revenue the West has not cut off yet.
There's one huge elephant in the room.
The Russia cord no one is able to cut, and more stories coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The effort to document war crimes in Ukraine has gotten strong international support, but what does it actually take to put a former leader on trial at The Hague? For an example, we look at the violence that enveloped Yugoslavia in the 1990s and the trial of Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic. In his case, a pivotal witness was someone on the inside, someone who turned against Milosevic after the war. The World's Chris Harlan Dunaway tells the story of two men, the witness, Milan Babic, and the prosecutor, Alex Whiting. Here's Chris.
Yugoslavia doesn't exist anymore. But when it did, it was a multi-ethnic country. In this story, you'll just hear about two groups, the Serbs and the Croats.
I'm Robert McNeil. Is Yugoslavia headed for civil war?
In the early 1990s, some of the leaders of the republics that made up Yugoslavia started fighting over whether they should go independent.
Serbia's president, Slobodan Milosevic, had been the first to inflame his people.
Slobodan Milosevic was an ethnic Serb nationalist who saw himself as leader of all the Serbs from all over Yugoslavia.
Air raid sirens wailed through the towns of eastern Croatia today as the ethnic fighting reached a new pitch.
The Croats and the Serbs armed themselves and started clearing each other out of their homes. Milosevic took control of the Yugoslavian army for the Serbs and sent them to Croatia to fight. In this long and bloody conflict, atrocities were committed by all sides. By the late 1990s, U.S. and NATO military intervention forced the Serbs to give up. The war was over, but Milosevic remained in Serbia, doing interviews, living his life. That is, until the UN Security Council set up a tribunal and indicted him for crimes against humanity. That was one step. But to actually convict someone for war crimes, that takes a ton of investigation.
I spent time in Croatia driving around, interviewing witnesses and victims.
This is Alex Whiting. He was a brand new war crimes prosecutor from America who had just joined the tribunal in 2002. Those witness interviews showed him what had happened up close.
These ethnic conflicts don't happen because people are inherently aggressive against each other. I think these conflicts are driven from the top.
Intercepted calls show that local Serb leaders coordinated with Milosevic in secret, and prosecutors exposed them. One of those local leaders was Milan Babic. Milan Babic looks like a boring bureaucrat, but he wasn't really. Back in 1990, Babic was giving fiery ethnic-based speeches to thousands in Croatia, stirring fears that the Croats were coming for the Serbs. And that was then. But after the war, things had changed for Babic.
And I think he was living almost a kind of retired life, raising chickens. And he sees his name in the Milosevic indictment, and he becomes convinced that he's going to be indicted. But he decided to take matters into his own hands, and he secretly approached the tribunal.
Two investigators from The Hague went to meet Babic at the Hyatt Hotel in Belgrade. When they got there, the former Serb nationalist Firebrand was sitting alone, drinking coffee, sweating.
His intent, his purpose was to defend himself, because he certainly did not see himself as a war criminal.
He agreed to keep meeting with the prosecutors in secret. In the videos of these interviews, the lawyers surround Babic at a table. The light is harsh on everyone's faces, casting shadows.
He had come in and testified without any kind of protection. He faced the genuine risk of us charging him and prosecuting him, and he would be much worse off.
Babic was taking a real gamble. But over time, prosecutors started to get to know him as a person.
You know, he was a dentist. He goes from being a dentist to entering politics.
It turned out that Milan Babic was also a political animal.
And this is the thing that Babic just sort of loved. He like fed on, was constantly talking about these different structures and how they worked and this. He was completely embedded in that kind of thinking.
But what was most notable to the prosecution was that Babic knew everything. He was in the middle of everything. And Babic had firsthand information that held Milosevic criminally culpable. But it came with an odd irony.
In the same words that he's using to inculpate Milosevic, he's also essentially inculpating himself.
Babic was only talking his way in deeper. So the prosecution pitched Babic an idea. Become a witness in the trial against Slobodan Milosevic. But there was a catch.
We can't just let you skate because you came in afterwards to tell the story. You also have to take responsibility.
Milan Babic agreed to cooperate.
All rise for Yevuleve.
And in 2002... the trial against Slobodan Milosevic began.
The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia is now in session.
There are hours upon hours of video from the trial, often this scene. Three judges in red-fronted robes seated at a high table up front. Slobodan Milosevic enters and sits in the dock. He doesn't have a lawyer.
Now, do you want some time to consider now whether you wish to be represented?
I consider this tribunal false tribunal and indictments false indictments. It is illegal.
This set the tone. Before long, Milosevic stops speaking in English, and the interpreters take over.
Mr. President.
Testifying against Milosevic could be dangerous. Witnesses were threatened. So some testified behind a shield of anonymity. And one key witness was someone the court codenamed C-61. C-61 was only described as a prominent politician from Croatia.
And when you watch the broadcast, you just see a blurry image and a voice, a distorted voice.
This is to protect his identity, of course. And Milosevic presses this guy hard through an interpreter.
But anyway, tell me this. Is this part of the report?
But regardless, it becomes more and more obvious who this witness really is. Like when C-61 says this.
As far as I know, Babic did endeavor to remain in the realm of politics.
He spoke about himself in the third person, right?
C-61 was, of course, Milan Babic, which changes everything, because he was involved in everything. And he tells Milosevic as much.
I would certainly not advocate the policy that you drew us into, and that is a policy of national divisions, separatism, rifts, and inter-ethnic conflicts.
Yes, but as Milosevic presses C-61, a.k.a. Milan Babic, the struggle forces him to make a choice. And this is where the transformation inside Milan Babic is revealed.
Answer, I repent for having become an ethno-egotist. That's true. I am sorry that I was an egotist at the time. I'm sorry because I am now fully convinced that it was the primary cause for all the things that eventually happened. It was horrible.
2 days later, Babic, who's still only known as C-61, does something no one expected. His defense lawyer stands up and tells the judges that Babic is taking a whole different leap of faith.
My client asks you to lift the order of non-disclosure in this case. He wants to go public.
You're watching the screen, and the judges say, okay, we're lifting the protective measures. And then there he is. He appears, and it's kind of like from behind the screen. Once you go public, then you're kind of crossing over, or you're recognizing or accepting that you have crossed over. Because, in fact, he had crossed over. There was no going back anymore. He was able to see through his own rationalizations, to understand that even though he had believed in what he was doing, he had ended up committing crimes.
In 2005, Babic was sentenced to 13 years in prison for crimes against humanity. Next time Alex saw Milan Babic, he was being held in the UN detention unit at The Hague, which looks kind of like a medieval stronghold.
What was really striking about it, what I really remarked, is that he was transformed as a person. He was no longer kind of frenetic and caught up in all these little stories and details and intrigues. He was calm, relaxed, much more clear, much more direct.
During weeks of preparation for other cases, Alex and Babic would spend hours together.
And, you know, when we were in the detention unit preparing his testimony, we would ask each other about our families and how he was and kind of sometimes laugh together, make jokes and, you know, relax. And it was very, you know, very human connection.
On the first day of Babic's court testimony against one of Milosevic's co-conspirators, he reads a typed statement expressing his own role in atrocities that took place in Croatia. Then Alex questions Babic for 3 straight days.
I want to put this question to you with respect to all of the intercepts that you've listened to.
If I'm listening to this testimony, it leaves very much an impression that, what did he do? Like he has talked a lot about what everyone else did and how it was their fault and they were responsible. But he has, in doing so, in telling that, he's kind of left himself out of the story.
Alex Whiting leans against the bench in his prosecutor's outfit, a black robe and white bib, with Milan Babic across the courtroom.
What did you plead guilty to? What do you take responsibility for?
And you see a moment where I think he completely understands why I'm asking that question.
In 1991, I succumbed to the passions of politics and ethnical egotism.
Babic finishes, and he's taken back to the UN detention unit, while Alex mulls over Babic's answer.
I remember thinking, okay, like, I wish you'd gone a little further than that, but that's okay. You did fine.
What's the significance of that question? The other significance of that question?
It's the last question. The last question I asked him. And then, you know, killed himself.
Alex was at home with his family when the deputy prosecutor called him with the news.
I remember going into the hallway and sitting on the stairs, and he told me that he had killed himself. And I just started sobbing. You know, and I'm right now just telling it. And, you know, I was at that moment, you know, struck by how strange it was. I was so strongly affected, you know, devastated by the suicide of a war criminal.
At the UN detention center in The Hague that night, a guard had checked on Babic, and he waved. All seemed well. A half hour later, another guard checked again, but it was too late. Authorities found no foul play in Babic's suicide.
I had come to The Hague to prosecute people like Milan Babic. But here I was affected in a way that was different. I had a different relationship to him. And there's really no word for that. I don't know what to call it. You know? I don't know what that relationship was. You know, I prosecuted him. I was sitting in court when he pled guilty. I worked out the guilty plea. I insisted on him pleading guilty. I thought it was important. It was something we pushed for. I played a role in him being in prison. All of us talked about it and thought about it and wondered and discussed and investigated and scrutinized why, you know, why he did it. And of course, he left, you know, the only note he left was to his wife, which was...
Babic tucked a note inside his Bible in his cell. I pull out a copy and start to hand it to Alex, but he stops me.
You have to read it.
Says, "My beloved, find peace for yourself and don't mourn me. I need peace. Your Milan, Sunday, 5th of March, 2006. Let the God forgive."
Yeah. So, you know, that's the only indication from him about why, what was in, going through his mind at the time.
Babic's suicide left Alex with complicated feelings. I ask Alex if he thinks he played any role in it.
At some level, I definitely played a role in it. I don't feel guilt about that, or I don't feel remorse or regret about that, because that the fact that he took his own life didn't change that he was right to take responsibility and right to testify.
Would you call him a friend?
I can't think of a better word.
Alex got to know Babic, laughed with him. They talked about politics, family, religion. But without hesitation, Alex put Babic in prison. Babic never saw the verdict in Slobodan Milosevic's case. Neither did anyone else. 6 days after Babic killed himself, Milosevic died of a heart attack in detention. The trial was brought to a close. For The World, I'm Chris Harlan Dunaway.
Evidence from Milan Babic lives on as a document. After his death, the tribunal made a new ruling. Testimony from witnesses who die can be used in court. Babic's testimony helped convict at least four other Serbian war criminals, including Milosevic's spy chief, who was convicted of crimes against humanity last summer, just before the tribunal concluded its work. Alex Whiting is still a war crimes prosecutor in The Hague. Sanctions on Russia. The U.S. and European allies have enacted round after round of sanctions to, among other things, freeze assets and cut off cash flows to Vladimir Putin and his allies. Almost 2 months into the war in Ukraine, are these sanctions working? To look at that, we're joined by Bill Browder, author of Freezing Order, a true story of money laundering, murder, and surviving Vladimir Putin's wrath. At one time, Browder was among the largest investors in Russia. Bill, let's jump right into this. Are sanctions working? Are they having their intended effect?
Well, sanctions are like medicine, which you apply to a disease. It depends on where you are in the course of the disease, how effective they're going to be. So if we had used even a small portion of these sanctions before Putin invaded Ukraine, he might have had a different calculation than he had by us not using them and then applying them long after he invaded Ukraine. And he was convinced that we weren't going to sanction him seriously because over the last 20 years, when he's done other terrible atrocities, we've done nothing. Now, we have these sanctions in place. At this point, in my opinion, they're not going to affect his calculus. So what's the purpose? In my opinion, the purpose is to deplete him of the resources to fight this war. And that's a much longer term thing to judge.
So let me start with this. Are you saying it's too late in the game, really, for sanctions to be effective?
I'm saying that we have to do everything we can, but we really blew our chance to do it on a much lower scale before. We could have had a much bigger impact if we had done it earlier. And now, because we've done it late, we just have to be complete about it. And if we're not complete about it, then the war will carry on longer than we would like it to.
So when we last had you on the program in early March, the U.S. Justice Department had launched a task force called Klepto Capture to track down Russia's elites and prosecute those who violate U.S. sanctions and then seize their assets. It's been active now for about 2 months. Are there signs yet of what impact this specific project is having?
Well, I think there's been some nice photo ops from this whole story. Yachts seized in different parts of the world, which is very satisfying from an emotional perspective. But I know how the Department of Justice works, and the real stuff is going to be happening over the next 5 years, not over the next few weeks. And that's going to be very ugly and detailed prosecutions of different oligarchs. And that's going to send a shot across the bow of all these people. But I wouldn't think that there's any major accomplishment other than a few photo opportunities that they've gotten under their belt so far.
5 years, that doesn't sound like it's going to have much of an impact on the war right now.
I don't think it will. The things that will have an impact on the war are weapons for Ukrainians and broad sanctions against all the oligarchs, not just a few of them.
So the latest round of sanctions announced this week, they're going after Russians and Russian entities helping avoid sanctions. It sounds like the U.S. is going after basically different heads of the same hydra. How can we be complete about cutting off Russia's cash flows?
Well, as you say, it's like cutting off the head of the hydra. Another one grows back, or another analogy is whack-a-mole. You have to keep on whacking. The Russians are very adept at obfuscation and hiding and all sorts of other ways of avoiding these types of legal challenges. And so we have to be nimble and also course correcting ourselves. And so this is good. This is what should be done, is sanction the people, and then sanction their family members and sanction their trustees, and then sanction the people doing business with them. And so basically it becomes a totally inhospitable place for them to do anything.
What else could the U.S. or Europe be doing? What would be more effective right now?
Well, nothing's more effective. We need to be doing all these things in conjunction. But there's one huge elephant in the room, and that is, while we're doing all these sanctions, which are good, and I think that will ultimately have some effect, and I say we, I mean the Western world, and particularly the Europeans, are still sending Vladimir Putin $1 billion a day for the purchase of his oil and gas. And if the war costs him $1 billion a day to run, we send him $1 billion a day in hard currency for oil and gas. And that has to stop.
By not sanctioning Russian energy, as you said, the elephant in the room, aren't all Western countries in a way enabling Putin?
There's no question that everybody who sends him money for his gas is enabling Putin. And there's some countries that we're not going to be able to stop from doing that. China is not going to stop. India is not going to stop. We're in a highly porous world where it's not going to be possible to totally and completely economically isolate him. But we can go pretty far, that's for sure.
In your book, Bill Browder, Freezing Order, you speak of the lengths Putin has gone to try and silence you for going after his money flows out of Russia. It's clear he doesn't want these flows uncovered, and it seems he's been successful. What do you think we don't fully realize about Putin's wealth?
Well, the other thing that's going on is that in order for him to achieve this level of secrecy and money laundering and exporting all of his dirty money to safety in the West, he's had to employ a large group of what I call Western enablers. And so we look at Putin and we say, he's a bad guy, and I don't think anyone argues with that now. But we have a lot of people who are working in big law firms, big lobbying firms, private investigation agencies, PR firms, that are basically working on behalf of the Russian security services in the United States and Great Britain and all sorts of other places. You know, and these are people who are like actively involved in laundering money, laundering reputations, et cetera. And these are the same people whose wives are at the Human Rights Watch dinner raising money. I mean, it's just absurd that we have these Westerners working for the Russian government in America as we speak. And nobody is really sort of focused on that. And these people don't seem to be ashamed of doing it.
And why don't we know more about that?
Because we haven't ostracized them. We haven't said, this is wrong, this is terrible, it's immoral. And in fact, we haven't made it illegal. And it should be. We should not have people working for the Russian security services taking money to do their dirty work in America. It just shouldn't be allowed.
So, Bill Browder, what do you see as the end of Putin's war and the end of Putin? I mean, walk us through one likely scenario that does not involve kind of natural death.
There's sort of three scenarios, one good one and two bad ones. The good scenario is that the Ukrainians continue to perform well in these military confrontations. We give them more and more military equipment. We do more and more economic strangulation of Putin, and he loses the war. If he loses the war, the Russian people will no longer have him. They'll get rid of him on their own. That's the best scenario. I give it a 15% probability. The most likely scenario is it continues to go on and on. There's no clear winner, no clear loser, more and more heartbreak and death and destruction and horribleness, on and on and on. 70% scenario. And then the real nightmare scenario is somehow he wins in Ukraine. Maybe he sets off a nuclear bomb in a town in Ukraine and everybody gives up. And in which case, then he'll be at the Estonian border or the Polish border with his guns pointed at NATO and his nukes pointed at London, New York, and Berlin, and asking us whether we want to go to war with him and seeing whether we blink.
That last one sounds like a nightmare.
That is the worst scenario, which is why we have to invest everything we have in the first scenario.
Bill Browder is CEO and co-founder of Hermitage Capital Management and the author of the just-published Freezing Order. Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you've missed any editions of the show, catch up on our website with stories and interviews produced by the world's journalists, like the efforts of one conductor to bring the songs of Kyiv's Shedrick Children's Choir to global audiences, and why American lawmakers are accusing China of spying on dissidents in the U.S., those and many more at theworld.org. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.